Welcome, everyone. Today is March 31st, 2026, and we are jumping right in. Imagine for a second, you're a soldier. You've been trained to take a life in the heat of battle, and society generally accepts that as, well, a grim necessity of war.
Right.
But then you're told that touching a prisoner's hair or forcing them to stay awake is a moral line you can never cross.
It's a massive contradiction.
It really is. Like, why does a lethal strike feel clean, but the intentional infliction of pain feels like a descent into something totally monstrous?
And that paradox is exactly what's at the heart of our exploration into the source material today. We're looking at a collection of essays called Confronting Torture, edited by Scott A. Anderson and Martha C. Nussbaum.
Yeah, it's a fascinating read.
It is. We're unpacking why a practice the world officially rejected after World War II came screaming back into the 21st century conversation. Because, you know, it's not just a legal debate.
Right. It's about the mind.
Exactly. It's a deep dive into what happens to the human will when it's under fire.
You see this all the time in movies like 24 or a Bond film, the whole ticking bomb scenario.
Oh, the classic Hollywood setup.
Right. A city is at risk. Only one person has the code. It makes torture seem like this logical, even heroic calculation. But our sources call this a moral sinkhole.
Because it is.
I mean, isn't it just a simple math problem? One person's pain versus thousands of lives?
It feels like math, but it's actually a broken compass. It feels like it's pointing you toward the truth, but it's really just spinning in circles.
Wow.
Yeah, in the real world, torture isn't a precision tool. It's slow, it's chaotic. And people will say literally anything, true or not, just to make the pain stop.
To survive.
Exactly. The ticking bomb scenario fudges the details of how interrogation actually works. It basically tricks you into abandoning your principles for a result that usually doesn't even exist.
So if it's not about getting the truth, it's just about power.
Pretty much.
And that brings up the question of how anyone even survives that kind of power imbalance. The book talks about Admiral James Stockdale, right?
Yes, he was a prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton for 7 years.
7 years. Unbelievable. And he survived using Stoicism, specifically the teachings of Epictetus.
Right. Stockdale tried to view his own body as, a poor, overburdened ass.
Oh, what?
A poor, overburdened ass. In Stoic terms, the body isn't indifferent. It's totally separate from your internal virtue.
Okay, I see.
The idea is that if a torturer hurts your body, they haven't actually touched you. They haven't touched the rational mind that holds your agency.
I mean, I have to push back there.
Go for it.
It sounds incredibly noble, but is it realistic? If someone is weaponizing your basic biological needs, like your need for air or sleep or light,
right,
isn't that a direct assault on the mind? You can't just evict yourself from your own skin.
You're hitting on exactly what Nancy Shulman argues in the text. This disembodiment is a really fragile shield.
Because the body reacts anyway.
Precisely. Torture doesn't just target the skin. It weaponizes the body's own reflexes against the victim.
Oh.
When your own survival instincts force you to let yourself break, you feel this profound sense of complicity.
Like you're betraying yourself.
Exactly. The torturer makes you feel like you were the one doing the betraying. That's the actual mechanism of the shame. It's not just the pain. It's the feeling that your agency has been totally hijacked.
And this theft of agency, it isn't always coming from some high-level interrogation manual either.
No, definitely not.
When we look at the abuses at Abu Ghraib, many people assume those tactics were Orientalist fantasies, basically using Western stereotypes of Middle Eastern culture to shame prisoners.
But Marianne Case's research suggests something much more homegrown.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it was actually reverse-engineered U.S. military hazing. It's what she calls the architecture of abuse.
Doing to them what was done to us.
Exactly. When soldiers are hazed during training, they internalize a very specific lesson, which is that dominance equals strength.
Right.
So when these soldiers were put in a high-stress environment at Abu Ghraib, with no clear rules, they just fell back on those same strength rituals.
So it's literally like a toxic animal house on the night shift.
That's a great way to put it.
They weren't looking for intel, they were just performing masculinity.
Precisely. They used feminization as the absolute worst insult, forcing men into submissive postures or women's clothing.
Because in that crude logic, being feminine means being defeated.
Right. The interrogators felt they had to prove they, quote, weren't pussies by stripping away the humanity of the person in front of them. It shows torture is often a learned institutional behavior, passed down like a virus.
But that virus destroys the host, too. There's that incredible testimony from L.B. Sachs in the book.
Oh, from South Africa.
Yes, he survived state terrorism there. He watched his former torturer, Sergeant Benzian, testify before a commission. And Benzene didn't look like a monster.
No, he was weeping.
Yeah, he was a broken man, weeping as he tried to explain how he could do those things.
It proves that torture dehumanizes the torturer just as much as the victim. Sacks actually calls the alternative soft vengeance.
Soft vengeance.
Yeah. It's the idea that the ultimate victory isn't doing to them what they did to you. The ultimate win is the rule of law.
Proving your system is better.
Exactly. Proving your system is strong enough to exercise restraint, even when it's most tempted to lash out.
So to summarize, we've moved from the solitary cell to the ethics of the ticking bomb, and we're seeing that torture is often a crude instrument of status, rather than a precision tool for truth.
It's all about that appearance of strength.
Which brings up a really provocative thought for everyone listening. If torture is a learned behavior passed down through institutions rather than some natural instinct, does that mean our civilized structures are actually the very things keeping it alive?
It's a chilling thought. If the appearance of strength is what drives regimes to torture, maybe the most masculine act is actually the restraint of the rule of law.
Absolutely. Something for you all to mull over. If we define our strength by our ability to dominate and break others, are we just building more moral sinkholes for ourselves? Or is the strongest person in the room the one who refuses to let the overburdened acid of the body dictate the soul?